Sometimes you feel so alone and overwhelmed, you don't know where to turn. These days, it seems like there is no end to our problems. We invite you to connect with Silent Unity, the 24-hour prayer ministry, where someone is waiting to pray with you right now. Since 1890, Silent Unity has always been there. No judgment or dogma, just someone affirming the best for you. Call 816-969-2000 today. You can also connect online at unityprayervigil.org.
Providing insight and resources for your spiritual journey. Unity Online Radio.
Welcome to World Spirituality, exploring the unity within all cultures and faith traditions, with Paul John Roach, Minister of Unity Church of Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas. Discover the universal principles present in all the world's religions and take an incredible journey to new understanding. Now, here's your host, Paul John Roach.
So hello and welcome to World Spirituality on the Unity Online Radio Network. Yes, I'm your host, Paul John Roach, coming to you from Unity Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas. This is my 8th year on the show. I've just completed 7 years. I'm the longest running host on Unity Online Radio and have hundreds and hundreds of shows under the belt now of this this particular world spirituality idea. It's a thrill to be in my 8th year. Thanks, folks, for tuning in and listening. Check back the archives sometime and see all the plethora and variety of shows we've had. And what better to celebrate my 8th year, the beginning of my 8th year, than welcoming back to the show someone with great insight, humor, and a good heart. He's a professor of philosophy. He's a blogger. He's a singer-songwriter with many awards in the local San Diego music scene. He's a writer for Unity Magazine. He's a wonderful guy. Welcome back to the show, Peter Boland. We're glad you're with us, Peter.
Well, thank you, Paul, and congratulations on 8 terrific years.
I know. It's amazing, isn't it? It's hard to believe. It seemed like only yesterday I started doing this, but it's been a thrill, and, just bringing this message to people around the world is a wonderful thing, and it's enriched my life, and I hope it's helped to enrich others who've listened in. We're talking about myth again, and myth is endlessly fascinating as a subject, of course, because it links in very closely with symbology and with archetype and with psychology and spirituality itself. You know, I was listening to a segment from the Jon Stewart show the other day, and he was interviewing Tom Huckabee, who's a former governor of Arkansas, of course, and now is had a Fox TV show for a number of years, and I think now is considering running for president. He'd come out with a new book, and it was contrasting what he called the Bubbleville of the liberal East and West Coast intelligentsia, and then the rest of us, the Bubbas, the Bubbaville, and that these two cultures just don't see eye to eye, and it's about time that Bubbaville raised up and made itself known. Of course, you know, I can't buy into that dualism of those two different cultures, and neither could Jon Stewart, and he sort of took it apart, but there's a myth right there, isn't it? There's the creation of a paradigm around, you know, them and us. There's this sort of the redneck, good old boy type people, and then there's the out of touch intellectuals of Harvard and Hollywood, to quote Huckabee on that. You know, he's kind of had it in for Harvard. That's not helpful, is it, when we get into these dualisms like this? I don't think.
Well, that's a really good way to open up the subject of myth, because myth often serves that role of being a narrative explanation of, you know, a very complex, multifaceted thing, namely reality.
So yes.
A myth can be, at its worst, I would agree with you, at its worst, a myth can be a terribly reductionist, overly simplistic sort of self-serving narrative. Notice how his myth contains the judgment that one of those categories of people is superior to than the other category of people. It's a, by definition, a divisive mythology.
Right. Yeah, and he kept saying, well, no, they're not superior, they're just different. But, of course, John Stewart kept pointing out, no, you're pointing to the fact that the values of Bubbaville, you know, are more to the core of America than what he said was Bubbleville. And, you know, there are differences, and we could agree on that, but I think in our culture, it's very unwise, isn't it, to be divisive, like you said, because there's enough things that divide us. We need to come together and understand that there's aberrations in both camps, you know, that nobody has a surefire understanding of the higher moral grounds here. And, of course, John Stewart played Ted Nugent's Cat Scratch Fever as an example, with Huckabee actually playing bass on it, as an example of, you know, maybe all is not necessarily well in Bubbaville there. And not to say I don't enjoy the song, but, you know, Ted Nugent is also not necessarily known for his expansive viewpoint of welcoming and embracing all sides of society.
His loving kindness.
That's a
really good way to open up this problem, that mythology can serve our higher potential, or it can trap us in tribalism. And
right.
it's crucial to not brand myth as either good or bad, but recognize that mythology, or in a simpler word, storytelling, can contain a value system, sometimes just implicit and not explicit, and it can be sneaky, the way propaganda and imagery and music and rousing rhetoric can whip people up into nationalistic or tribal frenzies. That's the shadow side of mythology. I hope that that people also recognize how mythology can be the medicine for that disease.
Yeah, and this show is going out live on January 20th, just after the Martin Luther King Jr. Commemoration, of course, the yearly holiday. And, you know, various shows were being aired. And what struck me about some of the marches, like the March on Washington and Selma and other events during that period of civil rights, was the dignity of it, the fact that there was so much work done to maintain peace and to hear from all sides, and there wasn't hate mongering, and it was the call to a higher level of discourse, I think, and that to me is a wonderful example of what you just talked about, you know, that because we did mythologize Martin Luther King Jr. and see him as a, you know, larger than life in a way, and yet, you know, he did so many wonderful things that enabled that to happen, you know, for him to be enshrined in that regard, and I think we look back on him today and that whole period you know, as a great movement forward for our nation into this this mythic quality of true equality, which is, you know, something that we've aimed for since the Emancipation Declaration, you know, 150 years ago now.
Well, yeah, Dr. King is a perfect example of a hero myth, of an individual who, not of his own accord, is called into a higher purpose, and at great personal cost, obviously, enters into this unknown, dangerous world where he has to summon all kinds of courage and power, his rhetorical power, his spirituality, his ability to organize, his rather cagey and he was really before his time in his cagey use of media and publicity, because he knew that social change comes about when society reaches a tipping point, when the consciousness of all of us, not just the people in Washington, changes. And that can be best brought about through television and through print media and so on. So he's an example of, well, let me say it this way. it is possible to mythologize his life or to see his life through the lens of this hero's journey, which all of us are on. And the hero, most importantly, fights the fights that they're going to fight, but brings back the prize, the boon that will, you know, the benefit that will bring healing to society. And tragically, as is the case with King, the hero is not well received when they come back. You know, Reagan called him a troublemaker, and a lot of people saw him as problematic, even within his own movement. So it's not a perfect person we're talking about. It's a living person struggling in real time. But yeah. Now, all these years later, we look back and all we have is the story and everybody's version and the monuments and so on. And now the film Selma, and it just goes on and on. You know, that's what artists do. They make films. They write songs. They tell the story. And we find in the beneath the particulars of the story the universal truths that embolden us in our own lives and in our own work.
It's interesting, isn't it, that so many of the folks that we do mythologize or turn into iconic figures for our time, you know, who carry the load of that freight of meaning, really, that is enshrined in, whether it be rock music like John Lennon, or civil rights like Martin Luther King, you know, they end up dead so often, and it's almost part of that martyrdom that is part of the mythology here. Not all people suffer that fate, because we have people like Nelson Mandela and right. the Dalai Lama, who, you know, are equally mythic in some sense, who have lived long lives, but it is true that, you know, so many of the ones that stand out, and I'm thinking of Abraham Lincoln as well, you know, their lives were cut short in a way, and it's almost to fulfill, of course, Jesus Christ, it's almost to fulfill the, you know, what's required of to make a true myth. You know, there has to be that martyrdom as well.
Well, sure. Socrates, Jesus, Gandhi. There are many examples throughout history of the hero who brought the change, the healing. And healing is by its nature antagonistic to the disease. And so political reform is by its nature antagonistic to the power structures of the time. Yes. So it's important to remember King as an agitator. You know, comforting the afflicted and afflicting the comfortable, as is often said, and that is sometimes the role of the hero. And naturally, you're going to have conflict on the end of that. And so, one of the things mythology can do is help us navigate all of those different stages, including that last very challenging stage. If the hero makes it all the way through and brings back the prize and stands there behind Johnson as he signs in 64 the Civil Rights Act and in 65 the Voting Rights Act, you know, these are monumental legislative moments of American change, and that
absolutely.
Prize is huge.
Yes, absolutely. Wonderful. I had Eric Mizell on my show last week. He's a coach and a prolific writer, and one of the things that he was talking about is creating life meaning and purpose. And he said that creating an icon, a personal icon, is powerful in this regard. And we're talking about these great icons of our mythology here, but I think that's true for us all, isn't it? That we can create an iconic word or image that it represents or means so much to us. I'm thinking about the mantra, you know, Je suis Charlie right now, that is sweeping the world. This idea of solidarity with the satirical newspaper, of course, after all the terrible killings there by the terrorists a week or so ago. And the fact that, you know, that rallying call can be powerful, kind of in and of itself. It has a mythic quality.
Yes, and that's the point, is that you have a couple ways to go with heroes, and one is adoration, devotion, and worship, you know, which at its worst can minimize the self and lionize the other. Or you can see the hero in Joseph Campbell's sense, that every hero in every story, whether factual or mythical, is a representation of the powers within us. As Campbell says, each of us is the hero of our own lives. So the hero is most powerful when she or he is inspiring us to answer our call, and our call may be different than a satirical cartoonist or a political civil rights reformer. Our call is our call, and it is only for us to hear and only for us to answer. And the hero inspires us by proxy, by demonstrating her courage, her sacrifice. We are alit and moved to finally find the courage to be who we really are and offer whatever gifts we can offer and face the terrifying ordeals before us.
Right. And, you know, for those of us who are spiritual and interested in the numinous, you know, Charlie Hebdo is the antithesis to that. You know, it's right. The world of secularism, and any religion is to be destroyed or pulled down. And yet, you know, having said that, I'm okay with them because, you know, I respect their right to have, you know, a viewpoint on these things and to you know, talk about the hypocrisy within religions or whatever. So it's just kind of a conundrum there, isn't it? It's they're attacking me as much as they're attacking Muslims, but on the other hand, I'm okay with that, you know, because it's part of the pluralism and acceptance in our society.
Well, look, freedom is a spiritual principle, and if we aren't free to self-actualize, if we can't speak freely, think freely, move about freely, without fear of oppression by any external force, then we cannot give full expression to our spiritual self, our Atman, our Christ consciousness. And so When we are spiritually offended by horrific slaughter like we saw in Paris, we are spiritually offended by religious ideologies wielded by violent oppressors, you don't have to know what that magazine is or know anything about the murderers to know that this was an offense against freedom and therefore a dehumanizing spiritual danger.
Yes, very well put. And that gives it its larger context, doesn't it, over and above just you know, their particular viewpoints around politics or faith or whatever. There's larger and more expansive values that come to bear on this, and I like that. It's inherently it is about the freedom of expression and you know who we are as a society in exploring that. I'm with Peter Boland, folks. And we jumped off into some interesting territory here already, haven't we, in terms of how potent myth is in our modern society, that it's not something that was written thousands of years ago and is just mythical, as in that modern use of the word myth, but it's very much potent in our everyday life today and can be very meaningful in terms of finding a validity for our own personal path. When we come back, let's talk more about some of those iconic ideas we may have around myth. One of the myths is the myth of suffering. You know, do we really have to suffer? But it's certainly a potent myth in many religions. And I'd like to talk about Paramahansa, the idea of the transcendent swan, when we come back too, as an image. So let's listen to these messages from Unity, and join me and Peter in a couple of minutes.
Unity Online Radio brings you inspiring programs on a variety of spiritual topics. Giving to the network is now easier than ever. Simply text Unity Radio to 72727 from your smartphone. You can make a one-time or recurring donation. Your gifts help us offer enriching spiritual programs that reach listeners around the world. Text Unity Radio to 72727. Thank you for your support.
Are we nearing the end of the world? Reading the book of Revelation, you might think so, and it doesn't end well. But is it possible that the Bible's darkest story is a positive tale? Author Ed Townley, host of the Unity Online radio show, The Bible Alive, thinks so. A Bible enthusiast, Townley focuses on the metaphysical meanings rather than the literal text. In Kingdom Come, new from Unity Books, Townley takes a fresh approach to Revelation. The kingdom, Townley explains, doesn't await us in the afterlife. It's ours to experience today as we learn to find the good even in our darkest challenges. Explore Revelation in a new light. Order the book Kingdom Come online today at unitybooks.org.
The world is full of voices, advertising, television, politics, colleagues, family, and friends. All are too happy to tell us how to live. In all of that noise, it's easy to miss the one voice that matters, your own soul. What would happen if you could hear that voice? Imagine the clarity, confidence, and courage that would be yours and the life you could create. Join Janet Connor, best-selling author of Writing Down Your Soul, The Lotus and the Lily, and Your Soul Wants Five Things, as she and her guests explore how to hear the call of the soul and create the soul-directed life. Live Thursday at 1 p.m. Central, only on Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Go inside to find.
We now return to World Spirituality with Reverend Paul John Roach.
All right, welcome back to today's show. I'm with Peter Boland. We're talking about the relevance and potency of myth. One of the myths that has lasted for thousands of years is the myth of suffering, the idea that in some sense, you know, to be human is to suffer. And the Buddha, of course, codified it so well, that saying that life is dissatisfactory or life is suffering, but there's a way through that. And you know, Jesus talks about it too, and maybe not so much as the church talks about it, because the church has really got into the suffering servant idea when it comes to Jesus himself, and then all the sufferings of the world, etc. You know, yes, life is suffering in the sense that if you've got a body, you're going to hurt, right? It's temporary. It's subject to sickness, old age, and death. So, you know, that is a mythology. But, of course, we would also counter by saying that, you know, there is pain, but to suffer unnecessarily is not part of the plan either, is it? And sometimes we've elongated suffering more than it needs to be, perhaps.
You know, Joseph Campbell says that myth has several purposes, and one of them is to help us make sense of our place in the universe and ascribe meaning to all of the different experiences. And when we come up out of our own private pain and we recognize the universality of suffering and the coming and going of all forms, it doesn't necessarily make us feel good, but it at least frames our experience of suffering in a larger universal context so that we can use it as a connective tissue and recognize that all beings suffer. And this awakens in us, of course, our empathy. And empathy is the engine of all ethics and all compassion. So one can kind of trace the path here of how as we mature in our approach to our own suffering, we realize that it is a key that unlocks a great potential, anyway, for goodness. I suppose that's one way of mythologizing the very immediate and concrete fact of pain and suffering.
Yes, and of course, those that can't feel that empathy, you know, for others' pain, you know, are psychopathic, aren't they? They're diseased, you know, that they have no fellow feeling, and that, and we fear those people because we see them as not part of the human community, you know, that is embracing of that suffering. So I think it's a potent symbology, I think. The other side of that is this idea that, you know, in the midst of it, we can be free of it. You know, this myth of samadhi on enlightenment, you know, immediate freedom. And I love the image of the swan in that regard. You know, the Hindus talk about the Paramahansas, the great swans, the great saints who have transcended the world, if you like. They fly high. And I was reading an article about the bar headed geese, I think it is, that are the swans of Asia, you know, that they could literally fly as high as Everest, and nobody really knows how they could do that with such little air, but they do follow the ground. So instead of flying from one peak to the next, they'll go down and follow the ground, so that in some way they are recharging their batteries, you know, for the ascent. And I thought that was interesting, but they're glorious looking things. They look a bit like snow geese. And, you know, I love the idea that they could transcend the lowly, you know, and fly over the Himalayas. They fly 300 miles across the Himalayas from India to China and to Tibet. And I find that very inspirational. And supposedly in the Hindu tradition, you know, the swan can, when it drinks, it divides the milk from the water, and could only takes the milk. In other words, takes the true value of something and discards the rest. And this is what a spiritual being could do, right? It can discern between what's real and what isn't. So it's a symbol of that. It's been my power animal this year. I don't know why, but I love that idea of the swan. Again, it's white, isn't it? So it has a purity to it.
Well, there's a great example of a mythic image, a metaphor, and just to go back to high school English class for a minute to make sure everybody's here with us, a metaphor from the Greek meta, or above, or over, and phiron, which means to place above an ordinary. So what we do with the metaphor is we take an everyday object like a swan and lay it over a much more mysterious and nameless idea, namely spiritual enlightenment or spiritual practice, and somehow that familiar idea conveys some meaning, some real meaning about that hidden idea that is underneath it. So metaphor is the method of mythology, and life is the laboratory. Myth is nothing more than a field of symbols and signs. They can be images, they can be entire narratives, they can be verbal, they can be visual, they can be musical. But those images, like the swan, convey something incredibly powerfully real. The problem in mythology is the confusing the metaphor for that to which it refers. What if a cult suddenly springs up that worships swans? We would all sort of giggle. But that's precisely what can happen in the misuse of mythology. We begin to worship the forms and the images and lose sight of what the forms and images are pointing to.
Yeah, that's brilliantly put, isn't it? Because it's so easy to, you know, like we say, worship the finger that points to the moon rather than look at the moon. And then we got some problems there because, you know, there's only one right swan in the universe, so to speak. And it sounds insane, and yet we would say that. You know, there's only one right way, and that's Jesus or whatever. There's only one right way, and that's my version of Islam. That's a sad case, I think, because obviously all these great way showers generally said, it's not about me. Jesus said, you know, it's I of myself could do nothing. It's the Father in me, the I am in me that does the work. And so, you know, I am the way, not Jesus, but the I am, the Christ consciousness within everyone, right? So these myths must point to a deeper, more universal significance. Otherwise they're weird. They become aberrational, really.
And this is what Campbell says in his epic first book, The Hero with a Thousand Faces. He says, wherever the poetry of myth is interpreted as biography, history, or science, it is killed. It is never difficult to demonstrate that as science and history, mythology is absurd. When a civilization begins to interpret its mythology in this way, the life goes out of it. Mm. And that is the real danger. It's purely a literary problem of confusing, you know, connotation for denotation. It's at the root of our creationism evolution struggle. It's at the root of so many of our other religious ideological struggles.
Right. And you know, I think it's the correlation between scripture and literature is interesting too, because we usually don't mistake literature for having to be the literal absolute truth, but we see it as a portal by which truth can be expressed. And I think scripture is like that too, you know, that it can be wonderfully pertinent as a portal to greater understanding. But once we say, no, this is it, you know, this is the one and only way of perceiving things, then, you know, like we said, it becomes a kind of a sickness in a way. I do want to quote from one of my favorite songs, and that's She Moved Through the Fair, because there's that lovely line there, talking about swans again, and fondly I watched her move here and move there, and then she made her way homeward with one star awake as the swan in the evening moved over the lake. And to me, like you said, it gives chills to me for some reason, because I'm Celtic, I guess, the silly old poetic fool. But, you know, having said that, there's something wondrous about it, this idea of seeing this swan on the lake in the evening. You know, there's a sort of a peaceful, mythic, numinous quality to it that speaks volumes. You know, it's more, like you said, it's more than just the simple everyday animal here. It's about our connection to something mysterious, if you like, that can elevate our days.
Well, that is the job of the poet and of the songwriter, is to select a few potent images, arrange them fortuitously in powerful language that throws us out of the domestic associations of our lives and puts us in touch with the mystery. And those lines are a perfect example of it. You know, I'm thinking also of Mary Oliver's poem, Wild Geese, since we're talking about large birds. That's another example of using the geese as a metaphor for our true self, our authentic self.
Yeah.
You know, somehow, you know, Mary Oliver is always writing about nature, and the fact that they move through the air, and she doesn't really tell you what that means, but boy, you just feel it when you hear that poem.
Yes, absolutely, because we do resonate, don't we, at a level beyond our intellect with these symbols and poetry and myth are tied together strongly, I think. And of course, W.B. Yeats, somebody like that, links them very, very strongly. But I think somebody like T.S. Eliot also, you know, the mythology that he creates in his poems, I'm thinking of the four quartets particularly, you know, link very strongly, and we resonate very strongly. And often they're ordinary places. You know, a little lane, a little cottage, a turn in the order of the day, instead of something around dusk or dawn. You know, these liminal places where we penetrate beyond the surface of things into something deeper, and myth can take us there, I think. And you know, it's a heroic point of view, isn't it? Let's look at a few myths. I wanted to look a little bit about the Grail. I know you're fascinated by Eastern mythology, and it's certainly very rich, isn't it? Especially Hinduism. It's amazing the amount of story and depth there is in the Hindu tradition.
Yeah, there really is. It's a rich cultural tradition to embody again these transcendent, liminal, mystical, powerful, and deep themes in sometimes very simple narratives, where you just populate a field with characters and you let them work it out, and we recognize ourselves in those characters. The you know, the Mahabharata and the Ramayana and all these wonderful stories of gods and goddesses and warring families and conflict and love and treachery and triumph. It's a little bit like a telenovela or a soap opera, but that's how it hooks us in. We see our family in that. We see our fears in that. So I just think it can never be overstated that it is artists who make mythology.
Right.
And that may sound controversial when you start talking about the specific scriptures of specific traditions. But to me, and this is just my opinion, Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass is scripture. Mary Oliver is scripture. Anything that throws me into, you know, when the hair on my arm stands up, I know I'm onto something.
Yeah.
And I can get that in a lot of different places, and certainly in Indian mythology. Richly.
I love the stories of Hanuman, you know, because they're so real, they're so human in some ways, you know. Although they're dealing with gods and goddesses, these gods and goddesses have all the attributes that we associate with being alive as human beings, and just as the Greek gods do, perhaps. And yet there's also, right, in the midst of that, there's sort of a transcendent quality. You're not sure what's going to happen next, and there's that redemption theme that goes through them, you know, because wherever that character is, there's always the possibility to move to a vertical dimension, you know, to a transcendent reality that sort of interpenetrates our human lives. And I love that idea, that, and that's true for us, you know, we can be redeemed by love, if you like.
And I think it's important context, it's important to remember that when you approach Indian mythology and you start reading about all of the gods, it's important to know that in Indian metaphysics, the gods did not cause the world. The world comes from the one, the nameless, of the Rig Veda. The gods are later than this creation. So in Indian mythological and religious consciousness, all of the gods are part of the created universe. Yes, they are above humans and they have all these fantastical functions, but they are still part of the same order of which we are a part. And so it becomes easier to relate to them, as opposed to in the Western tradition, we have an utterly transcendent God who is the source of the cosmos. We are not to relate with God the Father or Allah. Perhaps figures like Jesus and Muhammad are more relatable. But in Indian mythology, all of the gods are brothers and sisters in a way.
Right. And of course, there is, though, the transcendent aspect within that. You know, for instance,
yes,
if you follow the Shivite sect and see Shiva as the ultimate reality, and he has that form, but he also has a sort of an immanent, more personable form, you know. And I think it's the same with Krishna in the Gita. You know, there's right, the Krishna who walks side by side with Arjuna, but then there's also, you know, in chapter 11 or whatever it is, when he goes into his cosmic form, and you realize, right, that he is as limitless as the universe. So, you know, even in the midst of the cozy, you know, yeah, here we are having some nice myths that you can relate, mm-hmm, to. Don't forget, you know, that I am actually this transcendent, utterly beyond description, awesome power that interpenetrates everything. And I love that aspect of the Hindu myth as well, you know, that nothing's as it seems, you know, we're it's cozy, and then all of a sudden, boom, you know, there's this.
Well, right, there are layers, and everything is multifaceted, multi-layered,
yes,
that with depths that go down and down and down. Krishna makes it clear in the Gita that he is the Atman within us and within all things. And no matter what we worship him. And no matter which direction we're going, we're approaching him. And so he universalizes the Brahman Atman spiritual core of all things. So therefore, we too are to realize our Atman, and that's what he's trying to get Arjuna to do.
Right.
So there is this delicious kind of paradox. We are not the gods, and yet the gods are us. It's a beautiful mess, and that's what myth can do, is awaken us to that, not to analyze it, but to just experience it.
And that's life in general, folks. It's a beautiful mess. It truly is. And we love those juicy bits, don't we? That's what mm-hmm. makes life fun. So in the midst of all the suffering and all the difficulty, all the stress of life, and there's always a lot of that, we also know that there's a lot of adventure, joy, and possibility, and we affirm that to be just as strong and just as potent as anything that might distract us. So I'm with Peter Boland. We're talking about mythology. We're going to take another break, listen to these messages from Unity, and we'll rush right back to have some more fun for this third segment of the show. So see us in a couple of minutes.
I'm Dr. Tom Shepherd, host of Let's Talk About It on Unity Online Radio. In my studies of world religions, I've repeatedly encountered two central spiritual questions. How do we make sense of life? And how do we live it more successfully? You're invited to explore these two questions with me in my new book, The Many Faces of Prayer, How the Human Family Meets Its Spiritual Needs. You'll be amazed at the remarkable ways people have learned to pray to their gods and to celebrate life individually and as communities of faith. Learn more at unitybooks.org.
Notice how the funniest things happen when we stop taking ourselves too seriously and step out boldly? Listen to Funniest Thing with Daryl and Ed as these unlikely saints administer a refreshing dose of laughter and love that will inspire you to step out boldly and experience the funniest things. Join the discussion with Daryl and Ed live every Wednesday at 5 p.m. Central Time on Funniest Thing, only on Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Now back to World Spirituality with Reverend Paul John Roach.
All right, welcome back to today's show. We're talking about the potency and relevance of myth in our lives, and we get to choose, I guess, what myths we adhere to, what myths that resonate for us in that vast panoply of myths, whether it be those codified in our own religious traditions or other spiritual traditions that we may resonate with. A lot of people are fascinated by Hinduism, for instance, or we love the Greek myths because there's so much richness there. And they interpenetrate other forms as well in terms of poetry and art. So much potent myth is enshrined in great art, and that we can get inspired by going to a museum and looking at some of those great paintings, for instance, or sculptures. But ultimately, you know, we have to make our own myth, I think. We have to create our own meaning, don't we? And whatever that means to us, you know, I'm from Wales, so I resonate with many of the things that are Celtic. It seems to be in my bones, and I love the Grail myth because it's has an ancient British or Celtic tradition there going back. I find the Tarot cards very helpful too, because those archetypes that are in Tarot can be very meaningful, and they penetrate to a level beyond intellect into that intuitive awareness. Maybe America itself needs a new myth, does it? This myth of American superiority has sort of been shaken in recent decades, and maybe there's greater things for America to be than just to be superior to others. What do you think?
Yeah, you know, this whole business of American exceptionalism, that word is, to me, troubling and strange, and I don't personally care for it. I get what they mean, that there is something to be celebrated about the American political experiment and its ideals, but to use that particular narrative form of exceptionalism is, to go back to the beginning of our hour, too much like Mike Huckabee's division of the good people against sort of, you know, the bad people. By claiming exceptionalism, you immediately imply that everyone else is below that. And maybe I'm just hearing it that way, I don't know. But I think that there is something potent about what the United States of America has come to represent in its ideal forms to immigrants from all over the world who flood here and in the institutions that we struggle to move inexorably toward increasing expressions of justice, and there's a lot of good stuff, and people want to rightly celebrate that. However, when it is used as smoke to hide from us the injustices that have been a part of this system, that's a disservice, I think. So mythology, again, can serve us, and it can imprison us, and we have to, as you said, create a new mythology that incorporates our values of inclusion, of universal human dignity, of caring for the earth. You know, back in the 70s in the environmental movement, the old Greek idea of Gaia was resurrected and used as a mythological form. Gaia is the mother goddess of the earth, and in environmentalism, that means that the decision to view the entire planet not as a collection of organisms, but as a single interconnected organism in which everything plays a part. And that interconnectedness behind that Gaia mythic image is a very potent one, and that's a good example of a new myth, so to speak, in, you know, new wine in old bottles. I don't know. It's, you know, borrowing an old word, but reimagining it for the context of the crisis of our times.
Right. And we do tend to look negatively sometimes on the, you know, exploitation of our country in terms of ecological and environmental uses, but I think it also has a great track record of preserving areas, you know, preserving local yep. parks, but also national parks, and we have a great legacy of that, and that there's an honest and noble tradition of environmental writers and activists and poets and etc. And you know that's something to applaud, I think, as well as to bemoan, you know, transnational corporations who want to exploit the earth or whatever. So again, you know, it depends where you're looking, I think we will do well to reimagine America as a more mature society rather than in this black and white context, you know, of a Bubbleville and Bubbleville as it was, you know, put out by Huckabee. And, you know, he's entitled to his viewpoint, of course, but I think, you know, that many of us yearn for a more mature approach, you know, rather than choosing off sides and demonizing the enemy. So, you know, I'd love to see that discourse continue, I think, because that to me is how America could be such a strong force in our world. You know, it can let go maybe of some of the military might and focus more on what really is key to the American culture. I know it's hard to let go of that. You know, I'm British, so I see yeah. Britain, you know, the same way. I had a hard time letting mm-hmm. go of its empire, and there's still people bemoaning it now or saying, oh, we're just a shadow of our former selves. But I personally feel that Britain has morphed quite well into the modern world and is still contributing many things, you know, that are of value for a tiny country. It has a great influence way and above its size, and that's because it has institutions and ways of thinking that are still important in our world, whether it be the BBC or educational institutions. You know, it's still a powerhouse in terms of invention, etc. So, you know, there's many different ways to look at the success of nations, I think, and I look yeah. forward to America, you know, taking on a different way of approach in that way.
Well, you know, one of the reasons for British or American and British influence is the ubiquitous use of the English language.
Right.
Language
yeah.
is that set of symbols and signs that codifies reality. And when international business is conducted in the language of English, well, there you have a very fixed structure or framework. And I think you made a very good point about the national park system. I think it's one of America's greatest imports, is this idea that we should set aside tracts of wilderness in preservation in perpetuity,
right,
and not to view land for its instrumental value, as John Locke argued, but to see wilderness as a treasure in itself, as Thoreau so eloquently wrote. And Thoreau and Emerson before him wrote eloquently about nature as a divine realm. And frankly, in my opinion and many others' opinions, their views were shaped deeply by the Indians, and I don't mean American Indians, by the Vedas and the Upanishads, and this view, again, of universal spirituality. So it's very delightful to me that the all is one philosophy of the Upanishads came into the minds of Thoreau and Emerson and Whitman and many others and became part of the language of environmentalism.
Right.
The holy Bible of the environmental movement is Thoreau's Walden. And the only book that Thoreau brought to Walden Pond with him was the Bhagavad Gita. He was so shaped by that. So this is a nice full circle for me about how a mythological story like the Gita, which emphasizes our universal divine oneness, becomes the seed of American spirituality and the conviction that wilderness is the preservation of us all.
Yeah, beautifully put, and so true. And I just recently visited Concord again last summer and went round Emerson's home and went to Walden Pond and all those places. And you can't help but feel the energy there still. You know, it's there's a sense of peacefulness, but also power. It's as if, oh yeah, you could resonate with the inspiration of those still relevant people, you know, because their teachings and what they have to bring to modern America is still very current, I think. And of course, it led to unity, because unity came out of the mental healing movement, but also out of the transcendentalist movement, and owes much of its own theology and its own grounding in that oneness idea to those great progenitors of that, you know, back in the 19th century. So,
absolutely, I was just reading in American Veda that Charles Fillmore, in the second edition of what would become Unity Magazine, wrote a long piece where he quoted the entire poem called Brahma of Emerson and wrote quite a bit about the Indian perspective. And, you know, I'm just really honored to be a Unity Magazine columnist writing a column called A to Zen, whose mission is to explore Eastern spirituality through the lens of new thought. And It's a direct link into a global mythological framework that transcends all religions, really.
And we get to choose, folks. I think that's a good way to end the show today. We get to choose the myths that work for us and to celebrate that. These can be great ways of releasing the imprisoned splendor within us to live meaningful and active lives. And power animals, whether it be the swan or the wolf or whatever it might be for us, can help us do that. So can penetrating deeply into the riches of mythology, Hindu or the Grail or whatever it might be, or the mythology of modern sports, because the friendly rivalry of competitive sports, I think, can also be a way we can explore some of our aggression, but some of our loyalty and some of our ideas around courage. So sports can provide a great respite from the difficulties of the world too, not just a couch potato zoning out on popcorn, but you know, enjoying what they truly represent.
Right, and as we're going out today live, it's January 20th, and tonight is our great national ritual, the State of the Union Address, where we get to watch our president address Congress, both houses, and it's obviously a pageant and a ritual that is criticized as empty, but it's also kind of thrilling on a mythological ritual level to celebrate that which is great about our democracy.
Absolutely. And I think we need to take time to celebrate and to observe those moments, because it's part of the deeper, richer fabric of our nation. And we'd be foolish to jettison it, you know, in the names of just saying, oh, well, it's just pageantry. That's a good point. I'm at the end of the show. Let me tell you about next week, and then we'll say goodbye to Peter. And next week, the great Matthew Fox joins me. We're going to talk about his new book on Meister Eckhart, A Mystic Warrior for Our Times. It's a great book. I read it a little while ago. Fascinating stuff. Matthew, of course, is fascinated himself by Meister Eckhart, as I am. And this book really yields some new insights. So join us then. In the meantime, thank you, Peter, as always, for a fascinating, poetic, and insightful show.
Thank you, Paul. It's a great time. Thanks.
Yeah, appreciate it. And thanks, everyone, for listening. If you like this Voice of an Awakening World, send in a donation. Keep us on the air. And thank you for following World Spirituality, listening to these shows that I've been doing now, as we said, for 7 years. And for listening to all the other shows, there's some other fascinating shows on the Unity Online Network. We'll talk to you next week. All right. Bye-bye now. Bye.
Thank you for tuning in to World Spirituality with Reverend Paul John Roach. Join us every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern, to further examine the spiritual teachings and religious traditions of our world, and to discover the universal truth principles present in all. World Spirituality, only on Unity FM, the voice of an awakening world. This program is brought to you in part by Unity Church of Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas, celebrating the Christ Spirit in all people. Online at www.unityfortworth.org.
Just like life, grief is a journey, not a destination. Whether it is loss of life, relationship, security, or simply the process of change, have you given yourself permission to begin your journey of grief? Have you yielded to the gift of grace? Join Reverend Chaz Wesley every Thursday at 5 p.m. Central on a virtual navigation from grief to grace, and explore new horizons of empowerment, significance, and support. Only on Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
I'll light a candle in your name.
Inspiration only takes a moment. We invite you to consider these words from Unity author Charles Roth. Live deeply in the present moment. If you are going to work on the premise that real energy, real excitement, that feeling of being fully and enthusiastically alive comes from a source within you, then it follows that you have to spend some time getting acquainted, being at home in those far reaches of inner space. Peace is power. For out of stillness, strength is born, and out of inner harmony, productivity flourishes. Rest in that inner peace.
This meditative moment is brought to you by Unity.
The world is full of voices, advertising, television, politics, colleagues, family, and friends. All are too happy to tell us how to live. In all of that noise, it's easy to miss the one voice that matters, your own soul. What would happen if you could hear that voice? Imagine the clarity, confidence, and courage that would be yours, and the life you could create. Join Janet Connor, best-selling author of Writing Down Your Soul, The Lotus and the Lily, and Your Soul Wants Five Things, as she and her guests explore how to hear the call of the soul and create the soul-directed life. Live Thursday at 1 p.m. Central, only on Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Go inside to find my God.
Sometimes you feel so alone and overwhelmed, you don't know where to turn. These days, it seems like there is no end to our problems. We invite you to connect with Silent Unity, the 24-hour prayer ministry, where someone is waiting to pray with you right now. Since 1890, Silent Unity has always been there. No judgment or dogma, just someone affirming the best for you. Call 816-969-2000 today. You can also connect online at unityprayervigil.org.